Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Velocity of Content. It is Friday, April 30th, 2021. Today, as we do each week, we check in with Publishers Weekly on news from the world of publishing. Andrew Albanese, PW Senior Writer, joins me with his analysis and reporting. Welcome back to the program, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
So on our last podcast, Andrew, we noted W.W. Norton's decision to pause publication of Blake Bailey's new biography of Philip Roth amid allegations of sexual misconduct against the author. This week, the publisher decided to cut ties to Bailey unconditionally.
Yes, so just days after Norton announced that it was pressing pause on the publication of Philip Roth, the biography, Norton officials, as you say, decided to walk away from author Blake Bailey entirely, not only from this book, the Philip Roth bio, but they're also discontinuing Bailey's 2014 memoir, The Splendid Things We Planned, taking both works out of print. In an email statement, Norton said that it's putting the books out of print and reverting rights to the author, and Bailey is now free to seek publication elsewhere if he chooses. And I assume that he probably would choose to do that. But in addition, Norton said that it is going to make a donation in the amount of the book advance for the Philip Roth bio to organizations that fight sexual assault or harassment and to protect survivors. It's a stunning descent for Blake Bailey, who until just days ago was doing publicity for the book. And, you know, he's highly regarded for his previous works, which also include a biography of John Cheever. Indeed, Bailey's biography of Roth was released on April 8th, just weeks ago, with a 50,000 copy first printing.
Last Friday, Andrew, you said you weren't sure what next step Norton might take after pausing publication. And now that we do know, what's your reaction?
Well, it's a little bit more than I expected, I have to say, and I don't mean to sound cynical. I did believe that Bailey's Roth bio would not go forward at Norton, because once you press pause on a publication, especially in the first days of the book being on the market, well, you just can't go back and say, okay, all good now, we're going back. But, you know, to cut ties with the author entirely and to stop printing his previous book, I think it sends a pretty strong signal. Now, this all comes after a New York Times report revealed allegations of misconduct against the author dating back to the 1990s, and including allegations of rape from 2015 from a publishing executive who never pressed charges, but later wrote to officials at W.W. Norton to warn them about Bailey's actions. Truly terrible allegations for sure. But a few things I would point out here. And the first is that in 2018, I think it was, when Norton was first alerted to the rape allegation, it kind of seems like the publisher did not take the allegation very seriously. Now, they say they did. They shared the claim with the author, who denied the claim, but then everybody just went ahead with publication. At the same time, it's fair to ask, you know, how and what these processes are supposed to look like. Again, Bailey has strongly denied the allegations against him. So what is a publisher to do when presented with an allegation against an author who denies any bad behavior? And Bailey has denied the behavior. He's called it libelous and totally false. Now, in an article for The Guardian this week, author Francine Prose suggested that Norton was within its rights to pull publication of Bailey's book, citing the so-called morals clause. And this is something we've talked about on this show before, and it really became a hot topic in the aftermath of the Me Too movement and the Milo Yiannopoulos book, Simon & Schuster, as more publishers said they would start to look to include more such morals clauses. Now, a so-called morals clause in a contract would expressly permit a publisher to terminate a contract if bad behavior surfaces. And in some cases, it would allow them to seek to be repaid any monies that they paid out to the author. Now, the use of these clauses, it's controversial. And as Francine Prose points out in her article, because it's a slippery slope. And it's really hard to ask publishers to decide what's moral or not, and especially when it comes to allegations that are being denied. And as Francine Prose also points out, there are plenty of great books out there that have been written by not exactly great people. How do we deal with that? But let's be clear, we don't know if Bailey's contracts, which were signed a decade or so ago, even have a morals clause, or that this clause was cited by Norton in ending publication. The reality is, publishers don't need a morals clause to stop publishing an author. They have broad ability to terminate contracts and revert rights as long as they pay the royalties that were due under the contract. There's little recourse. Look at it this way. What author would sue a publisher to go ahead and keep publishing a book that the house has said it doesn't want to publish? I mean, you're just asking to be published very badly, right? It's common sense. You need your publisher to support your book, period, and no lawyer can force that. So anyway, back to my point. what is a publisher to do with allegations like this? And it's hard to offer a quick answer. But I can say this week, because part of the response one would hope at Norton is taking a good look at its internal processes for handling things like this in the future. Because whatever processes were in place at Norton in 2018, they didn't work. Because Norton's actions this week suggest to me that in its review, Norton officials, who once apparently brushed aside the claims against Bailey, now seem to view them as awful as they sound and to be credible. In a memo to staff this week, Norton publisher Julia Reed had acknowledged as much. She said, as a publishing company, Norton is limited in its investigative abilities. But at the same time, she recognized that certain situations, such as alleged criminal conduct, that the publisher should consider bringing in outside assistance. And she concluded by saying that Norton must balance its commitment to its authors with its commitment to the public, and must do so in light of, and I'll quote Reed Head here, the nation's historic failure to adequately listen to and respect the voices of women and diverse groups.
At Simon & Schuster, announcement of another potentially controversial title has stoked the fires of controversy further in publishing. Earlier this month, SNS CEO Jonathan Karp wrote memos to his staff discussing his decisions to cancel a book by one of the police officers involved in shooting Breonna Taylor last March, as well as to sign former VP Mike Pence to a two-book deal. The news this week is that SNS is signed on for a book by Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway.
Yeah, this one, it kind of makes my head explode, if I'm being honest. You know, as you say, many staff at Simon & Schuster were already pressing their leadership not to work with Trump administration officials. And what we learned this week is that Simon & Schuster now has Trump's, what many call his chief propagandist, that Kellyanne Conway has a deal with the House. So, you know, last week we talked about Simon & Schuster employees sending a petition. And this week we learned that there were something like 220 employees that had signed on to that petition to his leadership, urging them not to work with figures who were espousing what they consider to be hateful policies. Now, this was surrounding Mike Pence. The initial stories were about the book deal with Mike Pence. And I have to say, you can make the case that his VP, Mike Pence, has something to say, right? But with Kellyanne Conway, the alternative facts person, well, kind of extraordinary. So I'm going to expect that there's going to be more to come on this front.
And an A1 story, the New York Times on Wednesday, covered an issue we discussed on the show last week, Andrew, and that is a new relationship emerging between publishing leadership and their staffs. Simon & Schuster, the Times writes, has become a test case for how publishers are trying to draw a line over who is acceptable to publish and how firmly executives will hold in the face of criticism from their own authors and employees.
Yeah, a pretty well-reported piece, I thought, which, as you say, hits on what to me was one of the most important issues in all of this to emerge, which is that publishing staff are insisting on change and pursuing change at a pace that, you know, is more aggressive, perhaps, than leadership otherwise would. And I have to say, in my own opinion here, I think this is a really important development. But I'm going to go ahead and point readers to Washington Post columnist Ron Charles's piece this week, which tied the two stories from this week together, the Blake Bailey publication at Norton and the actions at Simon & Schuster. Now, Ron Charles offers a very cool take on Simon & Schuster CEO John Karp's efforts, which we discussed last week. You know, John Karp wrote two letters to employees. And he went ahead and called those efforts, Karp's letters, a coat and tie appeal to classical liberal values that Charles thinks were wholly inadequate to the employees who were petitioning him as a response. And I'm going to quote Charles here. He writes that while staff members were condemning the company for rehabilitating fascists, Karp was telling them, in essence, to just look away. And Charles goes on to question, but who could look away from publishing a rapist's book or a fascist? Now, I'm not saying I don't know where we draw the lines on these things. And again, where we draw those lines when it comes to who to publish and who not to publish is something that publishers have always wrestled with. And I know that in today's social media fueled environment, those discussions are hotter than ever. But the point that we discussed last week, I think Charles illustrates brilliantly in his article, and that's that publishing staff today are no longer content to, you know, shut up and dribble. They want to have more of a voice in what the company publishes. They want to be able to support what the company publishes. And Charles goes on to say that he suspects that some major publishers still don't really understand what it means to have a diverse workforce and what that all entails. It's not about making the office look like a Benetton ad, Charles writes. Rather, the goal behind a diverse workforce is to bring in a wide range of experiences and ideas and to empower people to act on them. And I think what we're seeing now are we're hearing voices who are empowered and asserting a different set of judgments than traditional publishing leadership has in the past. And I think that that is really an important moment for publishing. You know, and also I just want to say something about the cancel culture stuff that's going on out there, because I think the idea that there's these big nameless and faceless multinational corporations that are canceling people's speech is not doing justice to what's really happening in the publishing environment. Rather, you have people who are making decisions, and that's the nut of what is going on here. You know, it's not that some new cancel culture is emerging in publishing. It's that more people have more power to weigh in and to decide what a publisher, what the company that they work for should be comfortable profiting from. And, you know, they want to bring change. And you have a diverse generation that's coming in that is asserting more power. And in an industry that has resisted change for so long, and we talked about this last week, again, this is an important moment. Now, are these going to be thorny, uncomfortable conversations and decisions to make? Yes, no question about it. But I'm going to give Ron Charles and his great piece the last word here, and then I'm going to urge our listeners to read the piece and enter the debate themselves. Charles writes that books are not wholly contained creations. They retain their moral and financial connections to their authors. And ignoring those connections and pretending that a book floats in a vacuum is the privilege of people protected from discrimination, erasure, and assault.
While Penguin Random House recently announced that the company will be more remote worker friendly going forward, changes in public health guidance for the coronavirus must make Frankfurt Book Fair organizers feel a little hopeful over holding an in-person show in October. After more than a year of pandemic, Andrew, are we seeing a new normal emerge?
Well, we can certainly start to hope, right? You know, we had the news of Penguin Random House this week, which is, as you say, announced a tentative plan to start bringing employees back to the office. And they outlined the company's thinking on what that's going to look like. And the plan is to start bringing some employees back in as they wish in September, depending on what things look like in terms of public health. And of course, you know, Penguin Random House officials said that they were going to use their own, quote, cocktail of caution and common sense to decide how quickly they'll move forward. Precautions are still going to be needed. PRH officials said there's going to be guidance to come on vaccinations for employees and how to use and when to use masks and social distancing guidelines. And while Penguin Random House officials say they intend to offer an office for all who want or need one, the guiding principle is that they are going to be, as the Times reported, as PW reported, as many people have reported this week, a remote-friendly company. Now, that doesn't mean that everyone can work from home all the time, McIntosh said, but it does mean that those who choose to and are capable of doing their jobs from home, which she points out is most of the employees at Penguin Random House, as shown by 2020, well, they're going to be able to continue to do so in some form. And as a company, McIntosh pledged that PRH is going to vigorously support this mode. And I think that's a potentially important development, and not just for Penguin Random House, but for all workers. I mean, if this is the way things go, this is going to be a big deal for our economy. We won't even get into what this portends for real estate agents and commercial landlords and all the shops and restaurants that support offices in cities like New York. Should a fraction of the workforce decide never to really come back to their office, we'll leave the urban planning for a future podcast. But McIntosh also clarified that the current plans are not, quote, forever commitments, but a conversation that's going to be ongoing. And finally, news from the CDC this week, relaxing mask mandates for people who are vaccinated and outdoors. Some pretty common sense stuff from the CDC also represents, I think, an exciting step in the direction of normalcy or new normalcy, shall we say. And potentially bigger news, we understand that Europe is now planning to ease restrictions for Americans who are vaccinated and seeking to travel abroad. And you said it, for Frankfurt Book Fair organizers who have pledged to have some sort of live event this October, they have to be feeling very good that that might actually be possible. So a lot can change, of course, but the news this week is starting to point toward a future that I think does resemble normal, or at least a new normal. And after more than a year of difficult times, even minor moves like this have to count as good news.
Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly Senior Writer, thanks for joining me on the program.
My pleasure, as always.
Coming up on the next podcast from CCC, university libraries around the world provide safe and secure homes to vast stores of published and unpublished materials in physical and digital form, from books and journals to illustrations and photos. Alicia Wise tells me about a global collective effort to maintain authoritative versions of 43 million articles and 240,000 book titles.
For research libraries, there is a strong need to champion the importance of digital preservation within your organizations and to make sure that your libraries have clear digital preservation roles and responsibilities outlined. You can join and support an archiving organization, or preferably more than one. And investment in these services helps you ensure your researchers will have long-term continuing access to the journals and books that they value and metadata.
Making a backup for the world's knowledge, next on this CCC podcast. Our co-producer and recording engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burris Marketing. You can subscribe to the program wherever you go for podcasts and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening. Join us again soon for another Velocity of Content podcast from CCC.